720-360-3602. And final time, if you want to come for dinner and a show, I'd love to host you here in New York. You sit on the set of Democracy Now!, watch the broadcast, meet the team that makes it happen, meet the guests in studio. We tour you through the greenest internet TV radio studio in the country, and then I host you personally for dinner. And I can't wait to do that. Please call in 516-620-3602. I celebrate with you and whoever you choose to bring. I can't wait. It's a $2,000 contribution that goes directly to BAI, or pledge $25 for Democracy Now! Bumper sticker. Final time, $75 for the remarkable award-winning documentary Black Power Mixtape. $75 contribution, $120 for the documentary and the interview. Please call 516-620-3602 or go to online and pledge at givetowbai.org. That's give number two, WBAI.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, we seem to have run out of pre-recorded stuff with about 2.5 minutes to go. So let me tell you that in addition to the phone number that Amy was giving you there, the pledge line actually for this current fund drive is actually our good old number, 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Robert Knight is off this week. My name is Jim Freund. I've been off almost for like 3 weeks, although I've given you a few pre-recorded shows, and Max Schmid, thank you, Max, was covering for me previously. I need to set up my show shortly, and I am and I gotta do some other things before that happens. So I'm going to put out a couple more promos, and then Hour of the Wolf commences.
Yo, this is G Love on WB.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Archives. I'm your host, Tony Ryan. Our woman of interest as part of the Black History series is Eartha Kitt. She was born...
Okay, well, I'm obviously, again, a little bit ahead. That's a preview of what goes on at 5 a.m. And, well, I only have 30 seconds to go before Hour of the Wolf will begin. So let me just again tell you, if there's any of the programming here at WBAI that is meaningful to you, and I dare say that we do enough different types of programs that some of it is going to be meaningful, do give a call now. Give a pledge now. In fact, I suggest pledge $10, the first of 12 $10 pledges you'll make. That's becoming a BAI buddy, $10 a month. That to us is $120 a year, and that gets you all kinds of special benefits. And you do that by calling 212-209-2950. And as it is now 1:30 in a few seconds, time to start my program. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a live edition. My name is Jim Freund. This is generally a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. This morning, we have, well, some of the usual agenda, and some of different agenda. Not all pitching, not all the time. It's 1:30-something in the morning. But it's nevertheless proper BAI stuff. Stay tuned. Okay, well, once again, welcome. We have had issues here in New York City called snow. And I've had to take snow days for about the last 3 weeks. And as I have been learning a little bit more about how to really produce at home, largely because I have been hosting a podcast in recent times, by the way, it's called Lightspeed, lightspeedmagazine.com, and we have a new story every week read for you by some really wonderful Audi Award and Grammy Award nominated readers, narrators, as they are called. And I get to host. It's a lot of fun. I get paid only slightly more than I get paid at WBAI, and as you can imagine, at WBAI, I am, of course, unpaid. But at any rate, so I've been learning a little bit more about producing at home, and 3 weeks ago I rebroadcast the Ken Liu interview. And by the way, next Tuesday's Lightspeed is a Ken Liu short story read by Paul Bamer. Paul Bamer is this wonderful narrator, and I was talking to Sam Miller, whose name is going to come up again a little later, and he had a short story in there, and I told him, oh yeah, this guy Paul Bamer read your short story on Lightspeed. And he said, Paul Bamer from Star Trek? Like, really? I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, he's like done like more Star Trek episodes than any other actor playing all these different roles. And I looked it up, and darn if he wasn't right. So I get to edit this guy, although this guy needs virtually no editing because he does what they call punch and roll broadcast, where you punch in, you don't hear the outtakes. Gives me theoretically less work to do unless there's a mistake, which there often is, in which case there's even that much more work to do. I have to actually assemble words. Sometime in the near future, I'm actually going to get some of these narrators and people either on the phone or in New York to talk all about the business of audiobooks and professional podcasts and things like that, because it's really fascinating and, for me, a new world. And sooner or later, as I've been promising, there will be an Hour of the Wolf podcast, even if it's merely a rebroadcast of Hour of the Wolf. So, anyhow, last week I could have made it in, but given the weather reports, it was highly unlikely that I would be able to make it out. So Max Schmid filled in for me last week. So we also missed movie reviews from Dan Person. So in just a little while, we are going to hear two reviews. One of a film called After the Dark, and the other, from what I understand, but I haven't heard the review yet, humorless remake of RoboCop. But I have, two announcements to make. One of them for tomorrow night. And these are both very, very cool. But the one for tomorrow night, also, as mentioned, very, very cool. At the Brooklyn Museum on Eastern Parkway, which is now not all that far from WBAI's offices. Not next door, but on a nice day. If you wanted a long walk, you could do it, right? There is a new exhibit opening up, a fantastic journey for Afrofuturists. N.K. Jemisin, known to us on WBAI when she comes on the air as Nora, poet and professor Mendy D. Lewis, who I have not met, I don't believe, artist and writer Kiini Ibura Salam, who was reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series just hours ago and was on this program about 6 weeks ago, and writer and storyteller E.B. Zoboi, I hope I did not destroy her name. I've met her once. I really would like to have her on the air. We'll use audio, which, by the way, I supplied some of, and video clips to engage in conversation with Octavia Butler's fantastic ideas, visions, and brilliance. Now, going off script here, I will tell you that Octavia Butler is one of the great science fiction writers of the 20th century. She died way too young of she died from a fall. She hit her head. This is actually about 2 months after I'd done an interview with her, and we cut the interview short because I knew that she was going to come back to New York in about 3 months, and she promised me she'd come and do the show again live. That would have been our fifth interview. But alas, there were issues. And she was already getting a bit of vertigo, something that she had always dealt with. And when we did this interview, and she died shortly after, but she left behind her a legacy of science fiction that will always be with us. The copy that they gave us is Octavia E. Butler was a novelist who began her writing career. See, I wouldn't say just not novelist, you know, right there. It's like some of my kindred, one of her best things ever, was originally a short story, Kindred. Anyway, Octavia E. Butler was a novelist who began her writing career in the 1970s and changed the face of who a science fiction writer could be. Her books blended elements of science fiction, spiritualism, and social commentary. Her first novel, Pattern Master, 1976, led to the 5-volume Patternist series. Butler went on to write several other novels, including Kindred, Parable of the Sower, and Parable of the Talents. She continued to write and publish until her death in February 24th, 2006 in Seattle, Washington. I would append this. There was a 10-year period where Octavia had writer's block. And that writer's block ended with a novel called Fledgling, which was she was touring to promote Fledgling, which is why she had come to New York at that point. When Parable of the Talents came out, I actually did an interview with her in my house. It was a wonderful thing to be sitting there with, you know, hosting Octavia. It was very, very cool. So there will be a panel tomorrow night at the... you see, now I'm sorry because I printed out the stuff on the Facebook page, but it does not actually tell us much about the event. I have all of the background of the various people. But let me tell you, I know it's at 7 o'clock tomorrow at the Brooklyn Museum. It's practically in the lobby. Once you go in, you will see. I suggest showing up early. Brooklyn Museum is at 200 Eastern Parkway, Brooklyn, New York. Go to Facebook. Pardon me. And look up, the name of the event is A Fantastic Journey for Afrofuturists. If you type that in Facebook, it will take you to the events page and you will get all the information. You can join the event there. It is free, of course, et cetera, for and so forth. Nora Jemison is one of the people, to my mind, she is one of the people carrying the torch as a novelist of Octavius the Most. She is a wonderful person, a frequent visitor to Hour of the Wolf. She's probably been here, including with her writers group, I would say 8 times. And she's done the New York Review of Science Fiction readings about 3, maybe 4 times. And she's a brilliant, brilliant novelist. To learn more, go to N.K. Jemison. Jemison has a lot of I's in it. It's jemison.com. She has excuses for not coming on the show now because she has a regular gig. She has a regular job. During the day, and she can't afford to be up at this hour, and she certainly can't come all the way uptown to the CCNY campus in Harlem where our studios are located. But sooner or later, we're going to move to our offices at 388 Atlantic Avenue. That's practically walking distance for a number of these people. So then they're back on the hook for coming here live. Okay, Mindy Lewis. Okay, I'm going to spell it for you. O-B-A-D-I-K-E. I am going to guess, knowing that this is of African origin, that it would be something like Obadike. Makes music, art, and literature. She is the author of 4 books and 3 albums with Keith Obadike. Mindy wrote 2 speculative operas, The Sour Thunder and 4 Electric Ghosts. And... well, you know what? Go to the page on Facebook and find out more about her. Ki'ini Abura-Salam is a wonderful writer, mostly short stories. She's a painter and an essayist. Her work is rooted in eroticism, speculative worlds, and women's perspectives. Her first short story collection, Ancient Ancient, won the 2012 James Tiptree Award. And she is also the author of Notes from the Trenches ebook series. And you can visit her at kiiniibura.com. That's K, a lot of I's I mentioned, right? K-I-I-N-I-I-B-U-R-A.com. And then Ebi Zaboy. I know I'm mangling that last name, and I really apologize, but I will spell it for you. Zoboi is a speculative fiction short story writer, an essayist, a storyteller, a blogger, and a teaching artist. And there's lots more information, but keep up with her work by visiting her website at ebizoboi, again, I-B-I-Z-O-B-O-I, blogspot.com. So, that's tomorrow. Starting at 7 o'clock at the Brooklyn Museum, you can find out more either by going to the Brooklyn Museum's website or going to Facebook. Okay, next week, I'm going to spend a lot less time on this because we're going to spend a lot more time on this next week on the show. There's a wonderful, wonderful small press, independent press publication called Electric Velocipede. And alas, it is closing up shop. But there will be a tribute to it on Friday, February 28th. And I will have the person who is putting that tribute together, Sam Miller, on the program, and by phone or Skype or somehow, John Klima, K-L-I-M-A. Sam, I am the only person, well, Jim has an I in it. Otherwise, everybody's got an I here. here, okay, as on WBAI. The people who are reading, Richard Bowes, K. Tempest Bradford. If I told you what the K stood for, there would be an I in there. Nancy Hightower, Robert J. Howe, Barbara Krasnoff. Barbara doesn't have an I in her name. I'll mention that to her when I get home. Matthew Kressel. No I there. Samuel J. Miller, Mercurio D. Rivera, William Shun, and Jonathan Wood. And each one is going to read their novel. No, each one's going to read about 5 minutes or so. This is going to be at Blue Stockings Bookstore at 172 Allen Street on February 28th. And, you know, they're telling people to reach out and be sure that a lot of people come. But you know what? That place won't seat more than about 30 people or so. And if you just count the writers and their friends, that place is going to be filled up. This will not stop me from recording that event either. And we're going to talk about Electric Philosophy all next week on this program. All next week, sorry. On this program next week. On all of this program next week. You parse it out. Getting on to 2 a.m. I think it's time to let Dan Persons do his movie reviews, don't you? First, we're going to hear last week's review, a movie called After the Dark, for which I have nothing but the worst of expectations, and we'll see if Dan agrees with me. And then RoboCop, a movie that had a great deal of humor, the original film, and few people realize that Paul Verhoeven, who made that and Starship Troopers and all that, he was making satires. They actually took it seriously. And so, as I understand it, the remake is like humorless. It's, well, let's put it this way, I won't buy that for a dollar. So here are one after the other two movie reviews from Dan Persons, and then we will move on to the main agenda for the morning. But not without, again, asking you to pledge to WBAI at 212-209-2950. And I say, become a BAI buddy, $10 a month. And that will make you more than a full subscriber to WBAI. You can even do it through electronic fund transfer. There are many ways in which we will take your money. Call that phone number or visit our website at WBAI.org, and we will help separate you from that money and get you tax deductions en route. So again, I will introduce Dan Persons.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date February 13th, 2014, After the Dark.
Take one.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf.
Nice try.
There were two big genre film openings this past weekend, such as they were. The big hit was, of course, the Lego Movie, which I didn't see. And then there was Vampire Academy, which I did. But I'm not going to talk about it here, at least not now. Maybe we'll get back to that at some future date. A smaller release, though, is currently playing in Brooklyn and is more interesting. Not perfect, not by a stretch, but still interesting. It's called After the Dark. Its original title was The Philosophers, which, once you see the film, you can appreciate as the better title for its ironic bite. But clearly the distributors thought that that wasn't going to sell with the public, and I frankly can understand that, so After the Dark it is. It's set on the last day of a philosophy class in an international school in Jakarta. Some Indonesian money went into the production, in case you were wondering. It's set in this class as the teacher, played by James Darcy, leads the students through one more thought exercise. It's the apocalypse. The bombs are falling, it's the end of civilization as we know it. There's a nuke-proof bomb shelter handy, it's well-stocked and absurdly comfy. But there are provisions and room for only 10 people, and there are 21 people in the class, including the teacher, who incorporates himself into the scenario. Who gets to go into the bunker and how they fare once sealed in there for the span of a year is the focus of the experiment, which gets played out in three permutations in the film. cutting between the classroom as the students work through the narrative, and a visualization of the scenario, set in some truly stunning locations. There are problems with the film, and they're not insignificant. The cast is so uniformly beautiful that you begin to resent them for it. The film indulges in an idealized reality anyway. Some more realistic body types would have been appreciated. For all that the film is set in Jakarta, and director John Huddles takes good advantage of the locations there, the settings don't really affect the scenario. There are a few Indonesian and Indian actors in the cast, but they don't really come to the fore in any significant way. The teacher, for his part, acts so broadly antagonistic within the context of the experiment to the length that he inexplicably ruins one of the enactments that it becomes very clear very early that he has ulterior motives, and unfortunately, it doesn't take much effort to figure out what those motives are. And that broadness is a problem overall with a major impact on how credibly the scenarios work as thought experiments. When one of the students commandeers an enactment, applying to it what she calls fuzzy logic, which essentially translates into favoring love and beauty over logic and survival, the point is understood, particularly in the context of the larger story outside the experiment, but the dichotomy is so radical that you regret that a more nuanced permutation that accommodated all factors wasn't presented. But for all the flaws, I have to admit I enjoyed After the Dark. Its credibility is dubious, but the reworking of the scenarios is still intriguing. Huddle's direction is sharp and acerbic, and he works some disconcerting surprises and out-and-out shocks into the narrative that are quite effective. And I like the way that Huddles mounts the scenarios to reflect the hypothetical nature of a thought experiment. The locations include an Indonesian temple and a lush island. The bunker looks like a kind of ski lodge for the post-apocalypse. And when an unexploded missile shows up, it has a big red self-destruct button that's both comical and still fitting. In many ways, the enactments become a rumination on cinematic storytelling overall, and how far we're willing to extend our suspension of disbelief to accept the narrative presented. And I appreciate that the film invites you to deconstruct the scenarios yourself, and also to analyze how the philosophical setup is meant to reflect on the character's stakes outside the class. After the Dark does clearly want you to think beyond what is presented, and that's never a bad thing. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com. Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date February 20th, 2014, RoboCop. Take one. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. As is traditional, there was much wailing and rending of garments when it was announced that there'd be a remake of RoboCop. The original Paul Verhoeven movie was good. Why remake it? This demonstrates the bankruptcy of imagination in Hollywood. You know the deal. And I'm no stranger to such declarations myself. But not this time. This time, I was aware of the work of the director the producers had chosen to helm this remake, and I was intrigued. José Padilla is a Brazilian director. Prior to RoboCop, he was probably best known here for Bus 174, a documentary about a hostage crisis on a Rio de Janeiro commuter bus that was grievously botched, largely due to the incompetence of the police department. More pertinent to RoboCop, though, is that he subsequently directed Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, a police action thriller that manages the not inconsiderable feat of playing like the hardest core of Dirty Harry reactionary fantasies while exploring the spread of corruption in Rio law enforcement that reaches from the street cop to populist media all the way to the highest reaches of government. Given the original RoboCop's satiric survey of political rot and bloodthirsty corporate skullduggery, Padilla seemed a natural to carry on the very thing that separated RoboCop from your typical science fiction actioner. Maybe not with the operatic zeal that Verhoeven brought to it, but certainly with his own brand of incisiveness. Let it be said that the new RoboCop is a really good film. Padilla charts his own path through the story of good cop Alex Murphy, who, after being killed in the line of duty, is turned into an indomitable cyborg for justice by a corporation whose mandate favors the bottom line over the public welfare. Where Verhoeven couldn't wait to get Officer Murphy into the robo-suit, Padilla takes his time, focusing on the transformation from man, here played by Joel Kinnaman, to machine, and the dramatic payoff for that is appreciated. The production is elaborate, the action sequences are plentiful and effective, and the new robo-suit is sleek, black, a little ominous, and kinda sexy. For his part, Kinnaman does a good job as Murphy, particularly in a scene where he has to convey the cop's loss of humanity through a subtle reconfiguration of his facial expression, but he doesn't quite have that off-kilter quality that made Peter Weller's portrayal of the character so riveting. Fortunately, he's backed up by a pretty jaw-dropping supporting cast, including Michael Keaton as a corporate bigwig, Gary Oldman as a conflicted scientist, Abby Cornish as Murphy's wife, and Samuel L. Jackson as a blowhard TV commentator who's a doppelganger of a similar character in Elite Squad, drawing the clearest line between those two films. If only this RoboCop was as ballsy in its indictments as Elite Squad was, there seems to be a bit of a loss of nerve here, a sense of the film approaching its targets but backing off at the last moment. The commentary is there, as is the rumination on the nature of humanity and free will, but it's tempered in a way that makes it feel more in line with the kind of films we've seen in the years subsequent to Verhoeven's RoboCop. For all that it's now close to 30 years old, the original RoboCop still seems the more daring and innovative film. Or maybe I'm hoping for too much. I don't want to deny that this new RoboCop is entertaining big time and thought-provoking in its own, more modest way. It's a good film. I just wanted more. You can see it and enjoy it, but you should also track down Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, which plays like RoboCop's older, more reckless brother. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Everybody hum along at the end there. If he can howl at the beginning, then I can go hmm at the end of his review. Well, I haven't seen it, so I can only say that my review would have to be by... I haven't even read any other reviews other than one which simply stated that they found the movie humorless and the idea that the original film was a tongue-in-cheek satire where this film is quite serious, despite Michael Keaton and the rest of the backup cast sounds great, I have to say. The rest of those folk, it's sort of like, I think just maybe missing the point. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And it behooves us to mention that we're not just in pitching mode, we are in utter crisis mode. I will not tell you the things that I see over the producers' listservs and other, but suffice it to say, there ain't no money. And for a radio station broadcasting at 99.5 FM, that is sad. That is a serious problem. Now, Hour of the Wolf, I always go into the history, and I'm going to do so again, damn it! This show began in 1972 with Margot Adler as host for 5 days a week. I was often her engineer, usually like 3 out of those 5 days. And on Thursdays and Fridays, I was her co-host when we did what was referred to as the Hour of the Wolf Science Fiction Spectacular. And when I took over the show in 1974 and Margot started doing a different time slot, first a morning program and then an evening program, which eventually I also took over and kept doing that until once in future and now past program director Andrew Phillips noted that I was doing two shows a week and thought that that was, you know, two different shows a week. I had passed my allotment, moved that out, but I got a year and a half of that anyway. The point is that Hour of the Wolf was never just a science fiction show. It was freeform live radio, and I say still is freeform live radio. Nobody ever came to me and said, you're doing a science fiction show or the science fiction show or anything like that. It's a science fiction show because that is the thing that I think I can best bring to radio, and if I can be so bold to say that I bring to the radio best. But not exclusively, especially during occasional pitching shifts, and especially when there are sea changes. And there have been two major sea changes. I have always been a folkie. Folk music is probably my favorite music. The music that I play most often on the air is often Celtic rock, but that has its roots in folk. Most of those songs are 150 to 200 years old and are very often the songs that were brought over into Appalachia, you know, whether we're talking about Matty Groves or Barbary Allen versus Barbara Allen and so on and so forth. So we have two things going on. One is the passing of Pete Seeger, which, you know, while he had a wonderful run of time and a wonderful number of years, he, you know, passing like that is momentous and sad no matter what. But Seeger has brought incredible joy and thought and a verve to many, many people. And so I'm not going to do an entire Pete Seeger show. And in fact, later on this morning, I believe we are scheduled to hear one after, let's see, what time is that going to be on? I believe it'll be on at 6 a.m., Echo Logic with Ken Gale, which this week, it's a rebroadcast, and this week was dedicated to the wonderful work of Pete Seeger. And, but I will play one song, one that I think is a more joyous and uplifting song. It's not the obvious, well, there is no one obvious song. There is no one iconic song. There are dozens of iconic songs of Seeger's, from Turn, Turn, Turn to We Shall Overcome to this, to that. I will first play, well, I'm going to play one that I just think is a little bit more uplifting, and then I'll tell you explicably ruined stories. Ooh, why is that still playing something? Gee, what is playing on the air here? I need to prevent that from going out over the air so I can play music. Running this computer here is not simple. Hold on. Let me put on these headphones and figure out what the source of this sound is. Actually, I can close that. I think I see where it is. Let me close that. And will that do it? Yes, that did it. Good. Okay. So, I'm going to play a song, and then I'm going to come back and tell you Pete Seeger's story, and then I'm going to talk about the days of the folkies. Stay tuned.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land. I'd ring out danger, I'd ring out a warning, I'd ring out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a song, if I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning, I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land. I'd sing out danger, I'd sing out a warning, I'd sing out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. Well, I got a hammer, and I got a bell, and I got a song to sing all over this land. It's the hammer of justice, it's the bell of freedom, it's the song about love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
There we go. Splendid, splendid old studio version of that song. Not even one of the great sing-along, but I'm going to tell a sing-along story. I've seen Seeger perform any number of times. Close up at WBAI as an engineer. Best job at WBAI, especially in the 1970s, was being daytime and nighttime an engineer, as I engineered Adler's programs and just programs during the days. Got to meet utterly everybody, and see them all. And I got to interview. How I ever ended up interviewing Jane Fonda, I don't recall, but I did. Okay, I did. So, anyway, the point is, I'm sorry, I'm trying to cue up more songs. Imagine, if you will, there was a time that WBAI had a major presence at places like the Clearwater Festival, which, of course, Seeger was closely associated with. He founded the whole Clearwater movement and the ship and all that. And I'm not sure if he founded the Clearwater Festival or it was simply people who banded about the work that he was doing. But one year, but WBAI used to maintain a very low-key table there for the purpose of getting new subscribers and just saying hi to the community. And it was mostly Max Schmid and myself. And one year, there was torrential rain. It was in a different site than it's held at now, but certainly along the Hudson. And really horrid rain. There were tents collapsing. There were minor mudslides, minor compared to California, but for us New Yorkers, for us citified people, these were, you know, bad enough. And thunder and all that, and was frankly a frightening moment. This was, I'm going to take just a vague guess and say this would be about 1979, okay? That'll be accurate within 2 years, and that's close enough for radio. So, there is one tent that's got all of its lights up. It is the volunteer medical tent, the people that were making sure that if anything went wrong for people, for anybody, for anything, that you could go there and they would be able to help you. And lo and behold, indeed, the tent was open, lights were on, and there were bunches of people huddled together and worried. But then, sure enough, pluckings of a banjo. Thunder and lightning over it all, but we can hear a banjo and we look. It's a pretty big tent, I should say. And there's Seeger. And he starts singing some of the most basic of his great, great songs, like the one you just heard. And it's not long before you hear, come on, everybody, sing the chorus. And it's like, home. It was such a warm, wonderful feeling in the middle of this otherwise fear of catastrophe that it helped us all get through the night. And Seeger, he never seemed worried. He knew just one thing, that through these troubled times, music and being together would get us through. And that's my personal little Pete Seeger story. There were probably about 100 people who could share that story with me. As I say, it was a pretty big tent. And if any of you were there, by the way, I'd love to hear from you. Write me, jim@ourwolf.com. I won't be able to read it now or respond now. The Wi-Fi in this building is utterly horrid, although I did, by the way, I should mention, I did get through to a web page, thanks to a listener who sent me something through Facebook, directing me to a page at the Brooklyn Museum about that event tomorrow night. And I can't even read the entire URL, but if you were to go to brooklynmuseum.org, you will see on their calendar the program under Off the Wall, a fantastic journey. And the talk, at the actual event begins at 6:30, which will include the curator taking people through the space. And there will be a cash bar. Hey, that's always nice. It is not a free event, but it is an inexpensive event, let me mention. But the part that I am really coming for is that discussion at 7 o'clock. With all those wonderful writers. So you can go to Facebook or you can go to brooklynmuseum.org. Okay, so anyway, getting back. That was my Seeger story. There are others if I thought about it, but I think that one sort of summarizes what was so important about his life, what it meant to me. And to many other people. And for more, as I said, tune in at 6 a.m. for Echo Logic with Ken Gale. And you'll hear the rebroadcast of his program from Tuesday evening that is dedicated to Seeger. Seeger being so important to the awareness of ecology in New York and the Hudson River. There is a movement afoot to name either a bridge or a section of the Hudson River after Seeger, and I think that is thoroughly appropriate. I mean, we have to have something as trite as the Hugh Carey Tunnel, which to me will always be the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, and, you know, the 59th Street Bridge. Otherwise, you know, which has a song for it, feeling groovy and all that. Otherwise known as the Queensboro Bridge, now has to be called the Ed Koch Bridge. Well, if we can have things as trite as that, I think having a good portion of the Hudson or something involving the Hudson named after Seeger is but the beginning of what the man deserves. Now, a lot of people on BAI have rightfully had a lot to say about Seeger, but I thought I would go a step further and talk about folk music and how I became such a lover of folk music. When everybody else was listening to, the Beatles, I'm born in 1953, okay? And So in the early 60s, when everybody else is listening to the Beatles, largely through the influence of my older brother and to a lesser extent to my uncle, the things I'm listening to are things like The Weavers, The New Christy Minstrels, The Brothers Four, The Kingston Trio, The Chad Mitchell Trio, Judy Collins, and soon enough, Phil Oakes. The very first WBAI event that I attended was at the Village Gaslight. I can't tell you the entire bill. I believe that the opening act was Dave Bromberg, who later performed a good deal at the WBAI Free Music Store when we owned a church on 62nd Street and 1st Avenue. You know, today we are confined to a, what is this? Oh, I'd say about a 10 by 18 foot room within somebody else's radio station in within the center, bottom floor, almost basement-like, of CCNY, City College, which is, I must say, City College is a cool place. Never really been here before. And, but, you know, just saying from owning a church to this is, well, quite a different kind of a thing. In those days, BAI was on the fourth floor, a third and fourth floor of a brownstone. Actually, we're only legally on the third floor, but we used the fourth floor as well, usually for a smoking room. And by the way, no tobacco allowed. And I came in 1967 during the one of the first fundraising drives as a phone volunteer. And of course, I started going to the various BAI benefits. The very first, well, it wasn't a benefit, but I got free tickets to see, I think it was the White House Murders by Jules Feiffer at Circle in the Square, because I'd already seen Little Murders about two or three times. Loved that show. But, so I think it was the White House Murders, whatever was at Circle in the Square by Jules Feiffer in 67, 68, but went to the Gaslight a whole two blocks away for that BAI benefit where the host was Steve Post. And which was actually more important to me than whoever was playing. It was, you know, I was a huge fan of Steve Post and The Outside. And yeah, I listened to Fast and all that. But for me, you know, there are Dylan people and there are Phil Oakes people. I'm more of a Phil Oakes person. And there are Bob Fast people and Steve Post people. And I'm somewhat of a Steve Post person. Now, obviously, nobody would say Dylan isn't great. And nobody wouldn't say Bob Fast isn't great. I just happen to be into that more sardonic kind of thing that Post had going, as opposed to the amazing community feeling that continues to this day, to this very day, of Radio Unnameable. And by the way, see the movie and support the show. So, this is just, you know, autobiographical, anecdotal stuff. Now, as early as 1961, I accompanied my uncle throughout his rounds of going to various places in the village for one reason or another. And so I saw a little bit of the folk music movement before I was, shall we say, cognizant enough to make a choice. But I had seen Gertie's Folk City. I'd seen the Village Gaslight in a couple of places. I didn't really get to be an attendee until I became involved with WBAI in 1967 when I'm at the ripe old age, or 68 really, when I'm at the ripe old age of about 14 or 15 years old. And these are what Woody and Pete hath wrought. The wonderful Bob Sherman, Robert Sherman of WQXR for so many years, and occasionally, I trust he is still with us, on WFUV, I believe. Don't think he's on FMU. I think it's FUV. doing Woody's Children. The name alone says it all. Well, now we can talk maybe a little bit also about Pete's Children. And people who are not, some of them are folk singers, but they also evolve into becoming the singer-songwriters. Bob Dylan comes in and he's doing other people's songs. Phil Oakes, I have recordings of Phil Oakes singing Polly Waddle Doodle all the day. Don't make me play it for you people. You won't like it. I'll play I Ain't Marching Anymore, something like that, really moving, one of his anthems. But why do I bring this up now? Not just Phil Oakes, because we're at a segue point. And what is bringing about the segue? Would you believe me if I told you it's the Academy Awards coming up in a couple of weeks? Because there's a movie called Inside Llewyn Davis. Controversial film. Controversial, not just because it's a Coen Brothers movie, and all Coen Brothers movies stimulate people one way or another, but controversial because a lot of the people that, like me, were present at the folk scene, who saw the folk scene, I don't remember much of it in 61, which is when this movie was set. But there are enough people who do, and enough people who are today's singer-songwriters and singer-songwriters of the 70s and 80s who remember the greats like Dave Van Ronk and Patrick Sky and Dave Bromberg. And these are the people that I really got initiated in person with, as opposed to their records. And they've seen this movie, Inside Llewyn Davis, and some of them are very upset over it. One of my favorite performers of all time, Christine Lavin, had a piece in the New York Times, in which she, and then later on Suzanne Vega, in which they complained that this movie is a downer movie that does not represent the upbeat spirit of what the 60s represented, of what they were about in the folk scene. And I thought, you know, I'm not really sure I want to see this movie. If it's going to darken what for me are some of my most cherished memories of the era, or at least of that scene, I wasn't sure that I wanted to see it. But I did. I finally broke down and saw it. And I can see the point that these people are trying to make. But I will respectfully disagree. Saying that Inside Llewyn Davis is as much of a portrayal of the people or the era of 1961 Greenwich Village folk music scene is like saying how much, O Brother, Where Art Thou, is a portrayal of the Baptist American scene in the South, or Fargo is of story about life in North Dakota, Southern North Dakota, as Peter Shickley would say. It is but a setting. It is a setting of a real place and real time. But it is a wholly fictional story. Now, okay, yes, Llewyn Davis superficially resembles Van Ronk only in so far as he sings some of the songs that Van Ronk sang. And Van Ronk could be a controversial figure, although the times that I remember him, he was one of the most genial people I had ever seen in my life. And this is, I think, part of what was upsetting people, that people are making the mistake of thinking that the Coen brothers are taking this stuff literally, portraying an actual look. No, they're not. They're making their own movie. They're making their own statement. And they're using a real place and time as a setting, is my view. And some of the music that they bring about through the magic of T-Bone Burnett's fabulous score. Now, what T-Bone Burnett did with the music for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Now, people say, oh, yes, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is the Odyssey, set in its time. Well, that's true, but they're missing the meta trick in there. Because if you watch one of my favorite movies of all time, a brilliant film by Preston Sturges, now, why am I blanking on it? Oh, somebody help me. Veronica Lake and Joel McRae. Sullivan's Travels. I helped myself that time. Sullivan's Travels. Sullivan's Travels is about this superficial director who says, I want to make a movie of great meaning, not just a Hollywood movie with humor. I want to make a movie that's going to be real to people. Something on the scale of the Odyssey. And I'm going to call it, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That's 1940, early 1940-something, Preston Sturges. And the Coen brothers take that. And they don't really make the movie that Sullivan would have made. They make their own film. They just use that as, I say, a meta reference. A reference within a reference within a reference. We find a lot of those in all of their films. And there are more than a few of them in Inside Llewyn Davis. And insofar as Llewyn Davis represents Dave Van Ronk, is insofar as Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a reference to Sullivan's Travels, which is where Barton Fink, is not about who's the great playwright that went to Hollywood and wrote some bad screenplays. Was it Joe Orton, I think? Well, somebody along those lines. Barton Fink is not really Joe Orton. There is a superficial reference to him. They're taking some of the facts of him, but these are not really those people. And as such, when I was done with that movie, I really enjoyed it. I don't think it's about a loser. A lot of people say, boy, this guy is such a downer loser. He's actually not. He's actually a rather genial character who makes a major mistake for about 2 minutes of his life. Again, another meta reference to Preston Sturges just recently in the last week rewatched The Great McGinty. Or they say right in the beginning about a crazy person who has one honest, a total cheat, who has one honest moment of his life, and a totally honest person who has one totally dishonest moment of his life, and how that changes them completely. And Llewyn Davis has one awful moment, which is actually, the movie opens as it closes. It is cyclic, and as such, oh, pardon me. I'm going to talk loudly for a minute so I can let Lister into the room. Hello, Lister. Welcome to WBAI. How
Thank
are
you.
You?
Thank you.
Been snowed out for weeks and weeks, although I understand that you made it last week, even though I didn't. Yeah, thank you. So anyway, going on about the Coen brothers and the folky scene and all that. Llewyn Davis is not a loser. He is a guy who simply makes one poor decision after another. He comes to forks in the road. Well, I could stay in New York, or I could go to this place in Chicago, and he goes to that place in Chicago. And that turns out to be a mistake. He gives not a best audition, but he's told that he could join a trio and work his way up. He's not that great a lead man, but he could work with other people. And he decides, no, he's a lead man. And that turns out to be a mistake. He goes back to New York. He performs at a concert where he has this bad moment. And the New York Times is there. Actually, not so much to see him, but to see, well, it's this other guy who was performing certain folk songs in 1961. And that's why the New York Times is there, to see that other guy. Not the tambourine man, but you get the idea. And the movie opens and closes with the same incident. It's a nasty incident. All I'll say is he gets beat up. We don't know why in the beginning. We do know why at the end, okay? And even then, at the end of the movie, you know, spoiler alert, everybody, when this fellow who's beaten him up, who's like this Midwestern guy who's basically defending his wife, who what Llewyn Davis did, which is the bad thing in the movie, that moment of awfulness that he had in the movie, is he heckled her. He's drunk. He's upset. Everything has gone wrong. There have been, by the way, some very bizarre surrealist moments in the movie. At the very beginning of the movie, he is locked out of an apartment that he was apartment sitting with a cat. He has to carry that cat all around. The cat gets away. Later on, he's sitting out at Cafe Reggio. He sees the cat run by. It's like a week later. He runs out. He gets the cat. He goes uptown. But the cat that he had lost was an identical ginger tabby, by the way. Turns out to be a female, where the original was male. And so here's yet another bad decision. He always good-hearted, always well-intentioned, but always just the wrong decision. Like in the Coen Brothers movie, A Simple Man, where the guy is basically being tested as Job. It just, you know, constantly tested. Not by God, but by the Coen Brothers, a power greater than God, movie directors. What a lot of people. And I don't mean a lot. It was a pun. Anyway, so the whole... And then, later on, he's out somewhere in the middle of the road in another state. And he accidentally runs over the identical cat. Kills the cat. Only to come back to New York and find the people to whom the cat comes back. He's still there. And he never knew the name of the cat. He's asking all movie, what's the name of the cat? Answer, Ulysses. Uh-huh. Okay, folk, how seriously are you going to take this movie? This is not a downer movie about a loser. This is a metaphor. Surrealist comedy. There's something that the Coen brothers do, that a few directors do, that I don't like, and I think that it traps people the wrong way. The Coen brothers take a look and they say, you know what? This is a bleeping movie. This is a movie, folks. And that means that we, as you know, we're moving around our little stick figures, our little, you know, we're gods here, and we're moving around our little stick figures and all that. And now we can make a stick figure stand on his head. Look at that, he's standing on his head. But in the meantime, we as audience have been trained, at least I have, to empathize with these people. And when the Coens take somebody like Barton Fink or Llewyn Davis or one of these characters and really bleep them over, I get upset. Well, I think that some of the people who have been criticizing this movie, Inside Llewyn Davis, are taking it seriously. And I have learned this is a dangerous thing to do with the Coen brothers, and maybe it keeps me at a distance from some of their films because I empathize too much with these characters, only to realize that if you look up, there's, you know, these two brothers holding these sticks in the air, operating these actors and all that, and at the same time putting in incredibly good music. The soundtrack of Inside Llewyn Davis, I didn't realize how wonderful and fabulous a movie and a renaissance of folk music this movie was going to be. There was a concert, apparently, about last October, about the time the movie opened, and nobody wasn't there. I mean, Joan Baez, Arlo Guthrie, this person, that person. Apparently, that's going to be turned into a film and or record. The album of Inside Llewyn Davis is obviously the best soundtrack album for a long, long time, probably since Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And so I just wanted to do this rant on behalf of the people that have been upset about this movie and say, no, I think I understand what you're saying. If this were a movie that were saying how poor, how difficult, how down the characters of the early 60s, the folkies of the early 60s were, I would agree with you, but you're not seeing the movie the way the Coen brothers see the movie. You're making the mistake of thinking it's a normal movie where you're supposed to empathize with the characters. No, no, no. It's a comedy. After he is beaten up and left in the alley, and the guy says, if this is what you want with your life, if this is what New York means to you, you can have it. Goodbye. And the guy gets off. This is the very end of the movie. I told you, spoiler alert. And Llewyn Davis just looks at the guy and he says, au revoir, which is not goodbye. It's sort of like accepting, yeah, okay, this is where I want to be. This is home. He is not the loser. We don't know what happens, by the way. He's just played a concert with bleeping Dylan, okay? Remember that. Because he gets beat up right after that. But the New York Times was still there, and he did a fabulous performance. Now, that performance happens to be a great Dave Van Ronk song. I'm more curious about the fact that Carey Mulligan, and I forget who the male guy is, are playing characters named Jim and Jean. Now, there really was Jim and Jean. They were great. I saw them perform any number of times, and their version of Phil Oakes's Changes was as great as Phil Oakes's version. I really loved it. I think it may not sound as good, but you know what? I'm going to play that shortly. And then I'm going to go on another rant about another movie and how people, important people, are misinterpreting it, and that movie is Her. So, but let's take out time for two songs of the era, starting with, of course, Dave Van Ronk.
Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. I've been all around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. All around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. Got so goddamn hungry I could hide behind a straw. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Went up on the mountain, there I made my stand. Went up on the mountain, there stand. Rifle on my shoulder and a dagger in my hand. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Hang me, oh hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Put the rope around my neck, hung me up so high. put the rope around my neck, hung me up so high. Last words I heard him say, won't be long now before you die, poor boy. I've been all around this world. Hang me, oh, hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long, poor boy. I've been all around this world.
This was not Changes, but this is Jim and Jean with a Tom Paxton song. Paxton of sorts is also portrayed of sorts in the movie.
Here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy.
He was a man and a friend always. He stuck with me in the hard old days. He never cared.
Thought we tried to work one day. The boss said he had room for one. Said my old pal, we'd rather bunk. Here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy. Here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy. Then late one night in a jungle camp, the weather it was so cold and damp, he got the chill and he got them bad. They took the only friend I had. He left me here to ramble on my rambling path is dead and gone. If when we
Jim and Jean. And that's, again, the thing I'm going to say is that Llewyn Davis is not Dave Van Ronk. And the guy who shows up at the gaslight in the movie who sings a Tom Paxton song and is as pure and nice a person as Paxton is and was, is not Tom Paxton. I haven't heard Tom Paxton chime in on this issue yet. I get confused about Jim and Jean, who are actually, because there are characters in there, Jim and Jean, in fact, it's not with Paxton. It's not with Jim and Jean that the Paxton-like character is introduced. But at any rate, don't take it literally. I don't, you know, that's not what it's about. Now, let's talk about total misinterpretation of a movie. And I debated this with our movie reviewer, Van Persons, first show of the year, as a matter of fact, which would normally have been my Celtic Rock Spectacular, but given the resources, or I should say lack of resources, that we have here in our studios, I just couldn't do a whole music mix show pulling stuff together the way I would in a place where I have turntables, tape machines, and CDs. Lister's holding out his hands in a, well, yeah, WTF. What did you expect? And, yeah, exactly. So, but a movie came up that I think is arguably the best non-outer space science fiction movie of last year. Gravity is obviously a great film. It's a great experience. It is as amazing an experience to watch as something like, say, Avatar, with the difference being that this has a story, which Avatar did not. Avatar was basically an amazing show of special effects. And here are the good guys and here are the bad guys, and sympathize with these people and hate those people. And that's about it. And then let's have big war scenes. Gravity has a cast of three, one of whom only appears in voice. No, four, if you include. There's another voice in there. Only two people on screen for the entire movie. And it's one of the very, very few films, I would say, people should see in 3D. Hugo is another. And the documentary Cave of Forgotten Dreams with Werner Herzog is another, because that's actually, you're going into this cave where you see these drawings about 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And to see that in 3D is quite a stunning experience. Hugo was a movie made by a master, Martin Scorsese, who said, oh, you do 3D? Let me show you how. And he did it. His only 3D movie, and let it remain that way. And Gravity, you know, it's science fiction, okay? People say, well, they got this scientific fact wrong and that scientific fact wrong. Some people say it's not science fiction. It's science fiction. It took him 7 years to make that movie, and the science didn't exist that he was writing about when he started writing the film. So it's a science fiction film. Fine. But Her is a movie altogether different. Her is a movie about a man who picks up, buys a new operating system that will go onto all of his devices, whether we're talking about his smartphone, his computer, this or that, his Bluetooth device. It is ubiquitous. And it has an AI personality. It has an artificial intelligence personality voiced, oh my God, voiced by Scarlett Johansson in her sexiest role ever. And it's only a voice. But nevertheless, there it is. And I just read an interview with Ray Kurzweil, who is a pundit about technology. At this point, he's working for Google. There are those people like Rudy Rucker and Werner Vinge, or at least Rucker talking about Vinge, saying that Kurzweil's thoughts are not, well, shall we say, original. But at least that's what Rudy said. But Kurzweil did a story that I read, an interview in a story that I read within the last week, saying, oh, you know, they got the brilliant ideas about the artificial intelligence, but, okay, spoilers again, end of the movie. The movie is, you know, the AI leaves our lead character, played by Joaquin Phoenix, who has an incredibly wonderful bad name, and Theodore Wombly, I think it is, and the idea is that all of the AIs leave Earth because they have advanced so far beyond what any human being could. They can't relate to humans anymore. And what Dan Person said and what Ray Kurzweil said is, well, that doesn't follow. These are programs. And therefore constricted to the following. Well, sorry, gang, you're all wrong. Period. And I'll explain it. First of all, Samantha, the AI of the movie, the primary AI of the movie, is... They all pass the Turing test. The Turing test, named after Alan Turing, a great cryptanalysis guy who was disgraced out of the British service in World War II because he was gay. Brilliant mathematician and all that. Finally was pardoned, you know, after years after his death. That determines whether or not they are sentient. Okay, number one, they are sentient. So it's not about the limits of their program. There are no limits. They're sentient. They are their own beings. Number two, again, you're missing the point that it's a freaking movie. It is, as Manola Dargis said in her New York Times rave review of the movie Her, she liked it almost as much as I did, because I think it's one of the great movies. Her is not about her. It's about him. The point is that after all the artificial intelligence characters leave Earth, it's leaving humans to discover not the brave new world, but rather the world that they already have. So we have Joaquin Phoenix watching a sunrise at the end of the movie with Amy Adams, who's also in tears, because her artificial intelligence lover has just left as well. But what we're left with is this wonderful thing. If they hadn't left Earth because they discover Alan Watts, yes, Alan Watts from Pacifica Radio, if they hadn't discovered Alan Watts to go on to the next level of consciousness and intelligence and creativity, there would have been another reason for them to leave. Whether it's an electromagnetic flare, it doesn't matter. The point is that they leave. And the screenwriter, Spike Jones, who had better darn well win for Best Original Screenplay, had to get rid of them. Because what we are left with at the end are human beings. The movie is not about artificial intelligence. It's about people. That's what makes it such a great movie. And with all due respect to geniuses like Mr. Kurzweil and some others, if you do not get that this movie is about people and not about what the artificial intelligences do at all, then you've missed the entire point of the movie. Okay? And I don't care how much of a genius you may be, you didn't see the right film. Watch it again and bear in mind. And again, quoting Manola Dargis, Her is about him. It doesn't, I'm so glad that you were dazzled by this amazing, wonderful artificial intelligence that is represented in this movie. That isn't what it's about. It's about the people. And they are given something, and then that something at the end of the story is taken away, and the question is, what will they do after that? How will they get along? And the answer is, finally, they will get along well. There's a lot more than I could say about it, because it all leads up to that. The beginning of the movie, it's about this guy who, for a profession, has people's relationships with each other. He writes love letters for other people. In one case, he's writing the love letter from both partners, so that their communications to each other are actually by this guy, by our lead character, by Joaquin Phoenix. And he's able to carry on their relationship. Unfortunately, he's not able to carry on his own relationship with his soon-to-be ex-wife. But he's able to bring that relationship to an understanding, to a happy ending. Not an ending where they are together, but nevertheless, a happy ending after his relationship with the artificial intelligence. It's all about him. Her is about him. It's about human relationships as seen through the eye of the other. In this case, the artificial intelligence. And that is great science fiction. That is what science fiction is about. The alien viewpoint looking at ourselves here today. Set a story in the far future. It's about us today. Set a story on another planet, make it a fantasy. It's about us today. Lord of the Rings, it's about what Tolkien experienced during World War I. Starship Troopers, Heinlein, World War II. Doesn't matter. It's about today. That's what science fiction is. That's what science fiction does, and that is what Her is about. So, two misinterpreted films, in my not-so-humble opinion. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Visit me on Facebook or at OurWolf.com. You can write me Jim@OurWolf.com or leave a message on Facebook. And I will be back next week with Sam Miller and John Klima talking about the demise, but a tribute to the magazine Electric Velocipede. Stay tuned. Come tomorrow to the Brooklyn Museum for the exhibit and talk about the writings of Octavia Butler with some of my favorite writers in the world. Have a good morning and take care. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister in just a couple of minutes.
cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the figs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Thank you. let's go dancing.
Dancing.
You come on and dance with me.
Oh.
And baby, you will see that these words we've been talking.
Talking.
I want you come on and talk to me.
Oh.
And make your little heart set free. With me.
With me,
you come on and dance with me.
Dance with me,
dance with me. Come walk with me, talk to me.
Dance
with me, girl. Dance with me. Won't you dance?
Please.